Welcome. This will be the standard model. My name is Sean Tulin. I'm an assistant professor at York University, which is in Toronto, not too far away. Here's my contact information. You can email me, or you can stop by. I'm in room 272 in the Psy hallway. So if I'm around, just feel free to stop by if you want to chat. If you're interested in a textbook, let me just write this one down. I like this particular book. It's called Gauge Theory of Elementary Particles. By Chang and Lee. It's kind of older, but it's just the one I happen to like. And I'm not really sure, to be honest, if it's available in the library here. But any case. So we're going to be discussing the standard model. What is the standard model? Well, basically, it's the periodic table for elementary particles and forces. And it's our best understanding so far of all of particle physics to date. Since the standard model was established a few decades ago, virtually all experimental results in laboratories are consistent with the standard model, with one big caveat, which I'll mention. So it's really important to understand the standard model. Of course, it doesn't address everything. Cosmology and gravity point to two big open puzzles that are beyond the standard model. But if you want to understand physics beyond the standard model, it's helpful to first understand what is the standard model. All right, so today the plan is just to give you a very brief overview of what are all of the particles and forces in the standard model. So we're going to basically go through the entire standard model in one lecture, just to give you a sense of where we're going. Okay, so we'll start with the fermions, which are all spin 1/2. So I'll just write all of them down. And I'll tell you their electric charge in units of the proton charge. Known as E. So first, the first fermions, which I'll discuss, are the quarks. And there's six different types of quarks. There's the up quark, U. There's the charm quark, C. The top quark, T. And there's also the down quark, D. The bottom, the strange quark, S. And then the bottom quark, B. And here are their approximate masses. 2 MeV, 1.3 GeV, 173 GeV. The down quark is around 5 MeV. The strange quark is 95 MeV. And the bottom quark is around 4.2 GeV. And these are all sort of approximate. Okay. Then we have the leptons. There's the electron. E, the mass is around 0.511 MeV. We have the muon, the mass is around 106 MeV. We have the tau, the mass is around 1.8 GeV. And I forgot to write down the charges. So for the first three quarks, the up, charm, and top, the electric charges are all 2/3 in units of E. And for these second types of quarks, down, strange, and bottom, the electric charges are all minus 1/3 in units of E. For the leptons, well, you know what the charge of the electron is. The mu and the tau, it's the same. Their electric charges are all minus E. Then we have another type of lepton called the neutrino. And there's three types. There's the electron neutrino, the muon neutrino, and the tau neutrino. And their masses are approximately zero. So I'll write this as approximately zero. But I'll put a little asterisk here, which I'll come back to. And the neutrinos are all electrically neutral. So their charges are all zero. Now, we know experimentally that this zero is not strictly true. It's known from a variety of different experiments that neutrinos do have a non-zero mass. That non-zero mass, although we don't know precisely what it is many orders of magnitude lighter than the lightest one, than the lightest other particle, which is the electron. So it seems to be their mass is much smaller than all of the rest. We don't know precisely what the masses of these neutrinos are. So let me just write it in parentheses. Less than or around one electron volt. And so you might ask, why don't I put in what their masses are and just treat them as a free parameter? Well, it turns out that there's actually two different ways. Neutrinos are a bit special. There's two different ways in which I could include mass for the neutrinos. And experimentally, I don't know which one is the correct way. So strictly speaking, the standard model is defined with neutrinos treated as massless, although it's a caveat that we don't that they are not massless. So since we don't know which method for including the mass is correct, we just leave that out for now. And then we'll come back to that towards the end of the course. So those were the fermions. We also have bosons, which are spin 1 or 0. So the first type of bosons are the gauge bosons. Which are spin 1. So there's the photon, gamma. There's the gluon, which are called G. There's the W bosons, W plus minus, and then there's the Z boson. So the photon is responsible for mediating the electromagnetic force. The gluon is responsible for mediating the strong force. And the W and the Z both mediate the weak force. And those are the three forces. Next, I'm supposed to write down their masses. The mass of the photon is zero. The mass of the gluon is also zero. But the W and Z do have a non-zero mass. And in fact, they're quite heavy. The W has a mass of around 80.4 GeV. And the Z has a mass of around 91.2 GeV. Their electric charges are as follows. Well, the photon has no charge. The gluon also has no charge. The W has charge plus or minus 1 in units of E. And the Z is also neutral. The last type of boson which we have in the standard model is the famous Higgs boson. Labeled by H. And it is a scalar, spin 0. The mass of the Higgs is around 125 GeV, and it does not carry any electric charge. Okay, so those are all of the particles in the standard model. So, you may know that forces in the standard model are mediated by gauge bosons. So there are three forces corresponding to the three different types of gauge bosons that we have. And first, and most familiar, is the electromagnetic force, which is mediated by the photon. And you know the photon couples to particles with electric charge. The quantum field theory for the electromagnetic interaction and electrons is known as QED, quantum electrodynamics. The Feynman rules in quantum electrodynamics are very simple. So you have an interaction between the photon and the electron, like this. And from this Feynman rule, you can show that two electrons, an electron and a positron, have a potential energy, which is just the Coulomb potential. Which is just the alpha, the fine structure constant, divided by R. And that's it. OK. So that was the electromagnetic force. Next, we'll come to the strong force. And so the mediator of the strong force is a gluon. And so G, the gluon, couples two particles with color. Color is like the analog of electric charge, but for the strong force. Quantum field theory for the strong force, or I should say the quantum field theory for gluons and quarks, is known as QCD, quantum electrodynamics. You probably know that QED is based on an abelian gauge theory, a U1, based on a U1 gauge symmetry. The theory of QCD is built on a non-abelian gauge symmetry, based on the gauge symmetry SU3. So color is very different than electric charge. For electric charge, it's just some number. It can be positive or negative. Color is more complicated. There can be three types of color. I should say there are three types of color, which are written as red, green, and blue. And correspondingly, there's three types of anticolor, which I can write as anti-red, anti-green, and anti-blue. So quarks carry color. So I can think of every quark as a vector in this color space, where the components correspond to the direction in this color space, corresponding to the red, green, and blue directions. And then antiquarks carry anticolor. So the antiquark would be a vector in also in color space, where the components label the particular anticolors. Now, the distinguishing feature of non-abelian gauge symmetries compared to abelian gauge symmetries is that the gauge bosons also carry the charge. photon has no electric charge, but the gluons carry color. And so they actually, you can think of them as carrying both color and anticolor at the same time. So for example, I could have red and anti-blue, or green, anti-red, etc. If you're familiar with group theory, the quarks and the antiquarks transform in the fundamental and antifundamental representations, but the gluons transform in the adjoint representation, which means that it's sort of like a combination of both fundamental and antifundamental. You may know that there's only 8 generators for the adjoint representation in SU3, and so that corresponds to the fact that there's 8 different gluons you can have. So this is the number of generators for the adjoint representation. It's a little bit counterintuitive because you might say, how many different ways can I combine color, which are 3, and anticolor, which are also 3? You might come up with 9, 3 times 3. But actually, one of those combinations transforms in the singlet or triplet representation. And so that you don't count because we're interested in just the adjoint representation. So that's why there's only 8. So I can also write down the Feynman rules for QCD, interactions with quarks and gluons. So I have processes where I have a gluon interacting with quarks. This is exactly the same type of interaction that we have for an abelian gauge symmetry. The new feature for the non-abelian gauge symmetry is that the gluons also interact with themselves. So I have 3 gluon interactions, and I also have 4 gluon interactions as well. These types of interactions have no analog in QED. That's why QCD is a much, much different theory compared to QED. So the same way I wrote down the Coulomb potential for the electromagnetic force, I can ask, what is the potential between 2 quarks through the strong force? So let me write down this as approximately. So in some level, it's very similar to what I wrote down for electromagnetism. There's a part that's attractive, and it just looks like a Coulomb potential. But it has some different coupling, which I'll call alpha S for strong. But as you go to larger and larger distances, there's another term which becomes important, which reflects the non-abelian nature, or the self-interacting nature, of the gluon fields. And so that introduces a term that's linear in distance. So if I just sketch what this potential would look like, this is V as a function of R. The Coulomb potential would look like this. But the potential between 2 quarks at large distances will just increase linearly with distance like this. So for QED, if I ask how much energy does it take to separate an electron and a positron to infinite distance, the answer is that it takes a finite amount of energy. But for QCD, because the potential will just increase linearly, it would take an infinite amount of energy to separate 2 quarks to become infinitely far apart. And so this is a feature known as confinement. Because it takes so much energy, there are just, in fact, no free quarks. It is impossible to separate them, because it would take an infinite amount of energy to separate out a free quark. Sorry, I forgot an important word here. Okay. So the consequence of confinement is that all quarks must be confined to color neutral objects. These color neutral objects are known as hadrons. There are two types of hadrons. Well, there are two main types of hadrons. There may be other types of hadrons as well, but I won't discuss that. There are mesons, which are made of a quark and an antiquark. Write that as Q, Q bar. The reason that this is color neutral is because I can have a quark of a given color, let's say red, and the corresponding anticolor, anti-red. Combine red and anti-red, you get something that's color neutral, or also known as white, in sort of the color language. So I could just write red and anti-red is equal to white. The other type of hadron we can have is called a baryon. So that's a quark, sort of a three-quark object. Q, Q, Q. And the way you make something that's color neutral is you have to combine all three colors together. So if I have red, green, and blue together, this is also white. Yes.
What is the potential between color neutral objects?
If you want to understand that, you have to go into the realm of nuclear physics. So the potential is known from a kind of a phenomenological point of view, but it's very complicated. And it depends which nuclei you're talking about. Okay, so some very simple examples of baryons, which you're familiar with, is the proton, which is made up of two U quarks and a D quark, and the neutron, which is two D quarks and a U quark. Yes?
Why don't the potential between quarks asymptote to a constant at very short distances if we have asymptotic freedom?
So asymptotic freedom is a statement about how this coupling would depend with distance. So, but still, there's this extra factor of 1 over r. So you want to tell me that this coupling would become smaller and smaller as you go to smaller and smaller distances. That's true. But there's still, it's still effectively a coupling. And so independent of what that coupling is, I still have this interaction.
If it vanishes, if it decreases faster than r, then that's going to vanish.
If the coupling decreases faster than r, yes. The coupling is only logarithmically sensitive to, so you may know that the coupling will depend logarithmically on some energy scale. So it'll depend logarithmically on some distance scale, the inverse of that. So it's not going to decrease faster than that. Okay. This is probably obvious, but quarks carry electric charge. And even though that charge is bound together in a hadron, it's very simple to compute what the electric charge of the bound state is, just because electric charge is additive. So the total charge of the proton is just the sum of the charge of the two up quarks added together with the charge of the one down quark, which is plus E. And for the neutron, the charge is just the charge of the one up quark, and then added together the charge of the two down quarks. And so this would be zero. So I think everyone knows that. Okay, so that's all I'll say so far about the strong interaction. Now we'll come to the weak interaction. So all fermions couple to the weak interaction. So I'll just write down some of the Feynman rules. The Z will couple to all fermions. So F is any standard model fermion. And the W also couples to fermions as well. So let's consider the W plus, and I'm going to imagine that charge is going this way. And to conserve electric charge, I need to conserve electric charge at this vertex. And so the change in the charge between these two lines must be 1, which means that if I have a down type quark going in, I must have an up type quark going out. Color is also conserved, which means that I can't have a quark, for example, turning into a lepton that would violate the color SU3 symmetry. But the W will interact with leptons, and it will convert, for example, a neutrino. Backwards. We'll convert a charged lepton, E, mu, or tau, into its corresponding neutrino, or vice versa. Okay. The interactions of the W play a very important role in the standard model, because only the interactions of the W can change fermions from one type to another. The interaction of the photon keeps the fermion the same. The interactions of the gluons keeps the type of quark the same. But the interaction of the Z also keeps the same fermion going in as coming out. But the W can change one quark into another. And it doesn't exactly have to match up. You could go from a B to a C or a D to a T. Any combination here is allowed. It is more restrictive. You can only have E going to nu E, mu going to nu mu, tau going to nu tau. But nevertheless, the W is responsible for changing fermion type. If the W did not exist, every single fermion in the standard model would be stable, which means that, you know, in the universe, we would have every single type of quark and lepton populated. They would not be allowed to decay. But we know that only a small number of those fermions are stable and are present in the universe today, and that is because of the W boson. Now, there's also a very important interaction for the Zs. There's an interaction as follows. I can have a Z couple to a W plus and a W minus through a three-point interaction like this. And so this is kind of a hint that the weak force has some non-abelian nature to it. So let me just write down a couple examples of decays that can occur through the weak interaction. These are known as weak decays. So for example, I could have muon decay, or I have a muon like this, and it will change into its corresponding neutrino through a W minus. And then I have the electron and the corresponding antineutrino also coming out like this. Now, of course, the muon is much lighter than the W boson, but that's fine. There is no real W boson produced. It's a virtual particle. And so the W is not directly observed in the final state. The thing that you get is the muon decaying into an electron, a muon neutrino, and an anti-electron neutrino like this. Okay, now the other type of important decay, maybe familiar, but I'll just write it down, is a neutron beta decay. So in this case, I have a neutron, which will decay into a proton, an electron, and an electron antineutrino. And so I start out with a neutron, which is a U quark, a D quark, and a D quark. Two of the quarks don't do anything. Those are, if you like, the spectator quarks. But the beta decay corresponds to one flavor of quark changing into another flavor. So I can have a D quark, which can change into a U quark. Here's my proton, through the interaction of the W. So in this case, it would be a W minus. And then this W minus would go into an electron and electron antineutrino. Again, the amount of energy that this process has is only around an MeV, the amount of free energy that it has. And so the W is not created on shell as a real particle, but it's a virtual process. OK. So that, in a nutshell, is the standard model, survey of the standard model. And so the goal for the time being is to be able to write down the particle physics theory for the standard model. What is the Lagrangian of the standard model? Our goals, write down Lagrangian for the standard model. And it has two ingredients. let me just mention something else first. We want to write down the Lagrangian for all known particles that we found to date experimentally. So those are all of the ones that I wrote down. But we're not going to deal with several other important unsolved problems, which have to do with physics beyond the Standard Model. We're not going to include gravity in our theory. We're not going to include, for example, dark matter in the theory or dark energy. And for the time being, we're not going to even include neutrino masses, although those are known to exist. So we're going to try to write down the Lagrangian for all known particle physics. The ingredients that we're going to draw upon are two principles. The first is gauge symmetry. And we're going to need both abelian and non-abelian. Why is it that the Standard Model is described by gauge symmetry? We don't really know. It just seems to be an experimental fact. So we're stuck with this. The other ingredient which that we're going to rely on is renormalizability. The reason we want a renormalizable theory is that we want, in a sense, a predictive theory. Non-renormalizable theories can be predictive, but they also involve, at least formally, an infinite hierarchy of undetermined parameters which you have to fix based on some observables. So we're not going to be basing our Standard Model Lagrangian on a non-renormalizable theory. We're going to try to describe it with a renormalizable theory. In a renormalizable theory, of course, we can compute everything that we want up to a small number of undetermined parameters in Lagrangian. And when I say small, I really mean smallish, because as you'll see, there are, in fact, of order 20 undetermined parameters in the Standard Model Lagrangian. Okay. So to write down the Standard Model Lagrangian, we need to spend some effort talking about what's called the Higgs mechanism. And spontaneous symmetry breaking. So let me describe first what the problem is. You may not have realized that there's a problem, but there is, in fact, a problem. The problem is that the W, plus and minus, and the Zs are massive gauge bosons. There's also an experimental fact that the W and the Z have what's called chiral interactions. So you may know that the weak interaction violates parity. That is reflective of the fact that the W and Z couple to left and right-handed fields differently. And so that's what I mean here. They have chiral interactions. So the weak gauge bosons have different couplings. To right-handed and left-handed fields. So both of these two facts, as I'm going to argue, are problematic with respect to the two principles that we wanted to rely upon, gauge symmetry and renormalizability. So to illustrate this, I'm going to consider not the Standard Model, but a simplified version of the Standard Model. this simplified model is going to be a QED-like theory. With a massive photon. And the photon field will be called A mu. So let me write down the Lagrangian for this simplified theory. So it's going to be very similar to QED. I have terms with the field strength tensor, F mu nu. I also have the Dirac part of the Lagrangian. Or some fermion psi. But let me also include a mass term for my photon. The mass term would look like this, 1/2 some mass squared, a mu, a mu. So this would be the mass term. So let me just write out how everything is defined. So F mu nu is the field strength tensor. So that's just d mu, a nu, minus d nu, a mu. I have the covariant derivative, and I'm going to put in a new ingredient. But I'm going to assume that this photon state, a mu, has a chiral interaction with my fermions. And so that means that the covariant derivative will have the following form, d mu plus I, and then I'll have a coupling, which I'll call g left times p left, and then another coupling g right times p right. P left and P right will be the left and right handed projectors. I'm going to assume that A mu has a chiral interaction. So G left and right are the gauge couplings. For my fermion fields, left and right, which is the projector, P left and P right, acting on the field psi. And then my projectors are just defined as follows. P left and right are 1 minus plus gamma 5 over 2. OK. So first, we're going to worry about gauge invariance. So what does it mean to be gauge invariant? Well, I have to define gauge transformations. Under a gauge transformation, the gauge field transforms transforms as follows, where I have some arbitrary function, alpha of x. And then my spinners, psi left and right, transform up to an overall phase. So I can write that as e to the minus I g left right times that function alpha x times my spinner. So alpha x is some arbitrary local function. So it can depend on space-time. So f mu nu, you know, would be invariant under this gauge transformation. Also, the kinetic term of the Dirac Lagrangian, including the covariant derivative, is also invariant. But there are two terms that are not invariant under this gauge transformation. The first is the mass term. So if I have a mu, this transforms to a mu, a mu plus a cross term, which is 2 times a mu, d mu alpha, plus d mu alpha squared. So that's obviously not invariant. And also the mass term, psi bar psi, is also not invariant. So I can write psi bar psi as a sum of psi left, psi right, plus psi right, psi left. And then this will transform under the gauge transformation to be e to the minus, e to the I, g left minus g right, times alpha, psi left, psi right, plus e to the minus I, g left minus g right, psi right, psi left. So this term is also not invariant, provided that we have a chiral interaction, which means that g left is not equal to g right. So it's an experimental fact that the W and the Z have chiral interactions. And so there's a very simple way to make the standard model consistent with chiral, a chiral gauge symmetry. We just eliminate all of the masses. So if the mass of the gauge boson was zero, this term would be wouldn't exist. The masses of the fermions were zero, then this term would not exist. But it's also an experimental fact that these particles have mass. I can't just say the electron mass is zero. We've measured the electron mass. It's not zero. So these terms do exist. And so the question is, how do I reconcile the existence of mass terms with the chiral gauge symmetry? Before we get there, what else goes wrong with this theory? So the theory is also non-renormalizable. This might be a little bit of a shock, because you may know that to get a non-renormalizable theory, I should have terms in my Lagrangian with dimensions of 1 over mass, or 1 over mass squared, inverse powers of mass. There were no such terms in my Lagrangian. Everything had, all of the couplings had a positive or zero mass dimension. And so how does that lead to a non-renormalizable theory? Let me show you. So let's consider the propagator. And to start with, let's consider the propagator for, let me be a little more precise here. We're going to consider the Feynman propagator, time-ordered propagator. For just the photon, the usual massless photon. So that's d mu nu, x comma y. So this is in position space, it's just the time ordered products of the two photon fields, like this. And I can compute this and take the Fourier transform, and I get the following, that d mu nu, it's a function of k, is minus I eta mu nu, the metric tensor, divided by k squared minus I plus I epsilon. Okay. So this you may know, but I just want to remind you one way to compute this. And so then we'll see how we can generalize it to the case of a massive photon. So we can compute d mu nu using the mode expansion. For a mu. So let me just write out the mode expansion. So I have some integral over momentum. I have a factor of 1 over twice the energy. I have a sum over the polarizations, which are labeled by I. And I have epsilon, the polarization vector, mu, the polarization I, k, a annihilation operator. And then I have the Hermitian conjugates. So a simple way to compute d mu nu is just to take this mode expansion, plug it in here, and then just evaluate it. So let's do that. So we'll do a mu x, a nu y. And OK, I would have d3k over 2 pi cubed over 2e d3k prime over 2 pi cubed 1 over 2e k prime. I have a sum over the polarization vectors. Epsilon mu I k epsilon j nu k prime, and then I have a I a dagger k prime j sandwiched between the vacuum states. And then I have an exponential e to the minus I k dot x minus k prime dot y. OK. The reason only that one term survives, of course, is because I'm sandwiching everything between the vacuum state. So only the term that goes like a creation operator times the annihilation operator on the left will give me something non-zero. Then you evaluate this part here. It's twice the energy times 2 pi cubed times the delta function of k minus k prime. And then I have a Kronecker delta for the polarizations, delta ij. And so when I plug all of this in, I have d3k over 2 pi cubed 1 over 2e. And the sum over my polarization vectors. And then I have an exponential to minus k x minus y. OK. And then the way you evaluate to get what I wrote above is you use the rule that you can substitute in minus the metric tensor for these polarization vectors. And so this is the main part I wanted to focus on. That the way you get the metric tensor in the numerator is because you're summing over these polarization vectors as follows. So you get minus e to mu nu. This is for a massless photon. So now I just want to generalize this to the case of the massive photon. So a massive photon, you know, the photon only has 2 polarizations. It's massless. The massive photon will have 3 polarizations. The regular photon always has to move at the speed of light. But the massive photon, you can look at it at rest. At rest, it's easy to write down what the polarizations are. They are just vectors in three-dimensional space. So I can choose any basis for evaluating those polarization vectors. So let me just say they're pointing along the x, y, and z directions. So at rest, when k, the three momentum, is equal to 0, I can write the polarization vector as epsilon 1, mu, let's say points in the x direction, epsilon 2 mu, we can say points in the y direction, and epsilon 3 mu, say points in the z direction. So now I can just evaluate by hand what this product is. So I have a sum of the polarization vectors multiplied together. It's a 4x4 matrix, which is 0, 1, 1, 1 along the diagonals. And I would take mu nu components like this. Okay. Now, what enters into this expression on the left is not the polarization vectors evaluated at rest, but at a specific momentum k, and then I'm integrating over k. But I need to know how to evaluate this product for an arbitrary momentum k. So what I'm going to do is just boost by a momentum k. And so let me assume that my momentum is oriented along the z direction. So I'll have the energy, and then 0, 0, and then the three momentum k, only along the z direction. So I can define my Lorentz transformation matrix, or if you like, boost matrix, capital lambda, which is gamma, 0, 0, beta gamma, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0. And then I have beta, gamma, 0, 0, gamma. So this is just the usual Lorentz transformation. Gamma is the energy divided by the mass. And beta is the velocity. So it's just the momentum divided by the energy. So now, using this matrix, I can compute the product of polarization vectors at any momentum, k mu. So I have sum over I, epsilon mu I, 0. So this is what I started with. Now I'm going to boost by momentum k. So then I would get lambda acting on what I had before. So this is just lambda 0, 1, 1, 1 times lambda. And if I just expand this all out, I get as follows: k squared over ma squared, 0, 0, k times the energy divided by ma squared, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, and then I get k times the energy over the mass squared, 0, 0, and then k squared over, sorry, this is the energy squared over ma squared. Now, I was a little bit specific. I assumed that we were boosting along the z direction. But from this expression here, it's not too hard to see how to generalize it to be valid along any boost momentum k. I just need to take what I have here and generalize it the following way. So I need to write this expression that I have in terms of my quantities, which would transform in the appropriate way under a Lorentz transformation, which is, means I need to add mu's and nu's. So the correct expression is minus eta mu nu plus k mu k nu divided by ma squared. So let me just summarize. So the general rule for a massless photon is that I have the product of polarization vectors. Goes to minus eta mu nu. But for a massive photon, the same product goes to minus eta mu nu plus k mu k nu divided by ma squared. Okay. So then I can write down what the propagator is. I just need to make this simple generalization. Instead of having eta mu nu, I just have to substitute this expression here. So the propagator for a massive photon would just be I over k squared minus ma squared plus I epsilon with the minus. And so then I have just eta mu nu minus k nu divided by ma squared. So the only difference is this extra term here. There's a mass term in the denominator. But more importantly is this extra bit here that enters into the numerator. And so we're going to show tomorrow that this extra term can spoil the renormalizability of the theory, which you thought you had. OK. So that's all for today.